Welcome to another podcast in our series for the International Chamber of Commerce UK branch. My name is Jonathan Harvey and this is ICC's World Business Podcast recorded in London on the 8th of August 2017. Today, for the first time ever, we are filming this podcast, which will be posted and shared on the ICC UK social media feeds and our website at iccwbo.uk. For today's podcast, I have both Chris Fletcher, Marketing and Campaigns Director at the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce, and Chris Southworth, ICC United Kingdom's Secretary General. For sake of confusion for our listeners, I will be addressing Chris Fletcher and Chris Southworth by their full names. Thank you both for joining me today. It's great to have you on our 11th podcast recording. Chris Fletcher, okay. Let's start on the Northern Powerhouse. Why is it important that we continue to develop the Northern Powerhouse region? Is there an opportunity for Northern businesses to raise their profile at the international level?
Yes, it is important that there is still that continued development of the Northern Powerhouse region. I think before we get into the bits around, you know, Northern businesses and their standing at an international level, I think it's quite important just to sort of remind ourselves or inform people what the Northern Powerhouse is actually about. And again, you know, since George Osborne first announced it in June 2014, there's been all manner of interpretations and people, you know, putting things, badges and things as Northern Powerhouse and one thing or another. In our mind, Greater Manchester Chamber, it has always really been about connectivity. And that's connectivity between, you know, the cities and economic areas in the north of England, and also then between those areas and connectivity overseas internationally as well. And that's something that people sometimes forget about. So ultimately, at its heart, it is very much around being able to move, you know, people, freight and data around an awful lot easier than they can do at present. And that's where that investment has got to go into infrastructure. But then it's also about, you know, putting those businesses, those great businesses that we've got here in Greater Manchester and across other areas in the north of England, on the international map to say, you know, no more than ever really on the back end of the decision around Brexit and the next couple of years ahead, over what businesses can actually do, you know, and what they can offer. And also, you know, to get international businesses coming to the UK as well. So that investment has got to continue, and that development is absolutely fundamental to that process.
Thanks, Chris. So moving on, this is another question for you. And I hope you don't mind me assuming, but I expect that you already know this, but Manchester was recently named the third most active tech innovation city after London and Edinburgh. What does this say about Manchester's businesses and the city's role as a serious player at both the national and international level?
I think it says a lot, and I think it's quite, you know, it's almost building on the industrial past, really, that the city and the city region has got. You know, it's the home of the sort of industrial revolution. I think businesses have always had that element of innovation here. I'm not saying nobody else or nowhere else in the UK or anywhere have got that. Obviously, there are some great, you know, pockets of economic growth and some great businesses. But I think in the city here, I think people were to say what sets it apart. I think it is that level of innovation. I think what you've also seen over the last couple of years in particular is that real development beginning to come together now, those sort of cluster type approach. And again, people say, well, you know, that's all down to Media City and the BBC coming over and the spillover and the connectivity that's taking place over there. Actually, there's always been quite a strong sort of digital and technical sector here in the city. And I think what's happened over the last few years is the right pieces have been put into place to enable those businesses to work better together now and begin to put, you know, Manchester and the sector right in the shop front, both here in the UK and also internationally. And we've also seen that with, for example, some of the recent routes that have been launched from Manchester Airport, you know, a direct flight to San Francisco. We're talking about Seattle being early next year, and also, you know, to places in the Far East as well, you know, a direct flight through to Beijing, for example. So, you know, it's all got to work together. It's no use having a great set of businesses if you don't have that supporting infrastructure. A little bit like the Northern Powerhouse, really. You know, if you've not got the will to support or the capability to support those businesses, you're never, ever going to perform at that level. What we've got here is a great, outstanding set of businesses with a great support mechanism, and now things are really beginning to take shape. So I think there is a serious intent here that, you know, it's not some sort of overnight flash in the pan. This is serious stuff we're looking at.
Thanks, Chris. I'm just going to bring in Chris Southworth now, because I want to see what his thoughts are on this. Is this an opportunity to increase the profile of Northern businesses as influencers to international institutions?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is, and I totally endorse Chris Fletcher's comments there. And I think the North, the historic background in the North has always been a global player. It's only over recent history that actually the voice of the North has not necessarily been as high profile as it used to be at international level. What we see is having kind of observed how businesses are engaging at policy level, there tends to be very intense engagement at local level, at national level, and at EU level, regional level. But that engagement then tapers off quite dramatically at global level. It's so important that companies are able to, one, have a profile, but two, are able to influence the global policy agenda, because it's that global policy agenda that influences the operating environment, particularly in emerging markets outside of Europe. So if we're not having a say, we're not at the table, then we're effectively allowing the rest of the world to decide what that operating environment looks and feels like. That clearly is not sustainable. And it's equally not sustainable or right that the North is not represented as part of the UK voice. On the plus side, I totally agree with Chris. There's lots of great branded companies that come from the North. There are huge expertise up there across a whole range of different sectors. We just need to take that voice and expertise and remind the world just what comes from the North. Our job is to be a conduit for the voice, working alongside the likes of Chris. All I would flag up is we talk a lot about free trade. The UK is clearly a founder member of the free trade movement. But in the ICC Open Markets Index, we rank some of the 28. You know, our peers are the likes of Mexico. We're not at the forefront of free trade in terms of as a market. So there's still work to do. That doesn't mean that, you know, we'll ever be perfect. We're a big, complicated economy, but there's clearly work to do. And that infrastructure, skills, local framework for businesses to trade is so important. The countries that are at the top end of that open market index tend to have better infrastructure, good policy, good regionalised policy. The benefits of trade and policy making are distributed. That's why it's so important the Northern Powerhouse has a say and is involved.
Thank you both. On to my next question. Funding has increased into the North, which is good news for the region. How exactly are these funds improving trade infrastructure like transport, schools, workforce skills? Can you give examples? Chris Fletcher, perhaps you'd like to comment on this.
Yeah, I mean, there has been an increase into funding into the north of England and, you know, into certain areas. You know, other areas have got more than others within that as any sort of regional funding pot always sort of breaks down into, you know, some areas seem to be winners and other areas not so. I think the other bit around it is quite important because it's not just the availability of the funds, it's also, you know, the decision-making process over how those funds are spent. And we're still in this sort of midpoint sort of really where we have now got an elected mayor, for example, in Greater Manchester, and we are fully supportive of that model. And again, Andy Burnham, who is the mayor, has got a huge range of financial decision-making powers already around transport, around health and social care, a little bit on education. But there are still some things that he has no control over, and that is still controlled by central government. So all the, you know, schools and workforce skills, although we can see where that's beginning to go to. So I think it's quite important that where that money is available, you also need the right sort of governance model you can collect to make sure it's going where, quite frankly, businesses say they need it. When you speak to many business owners who work on a regular basis, you know, you can identify where they need that money putting into workforce skills. But more and more businesses are saying you actually need to look at schools and beginning to make sure that young people coming out of schools are aware of what the opportunities are for them when they go into that world of work. And I think that's quite important. So, yes, there are some obvious bits to get funded. You know, we've seen a lot of investment into infrastructure, a lot more to come. We've had announcements over things like HS2, for example, high-speed rail line coming out of Birmingham now into Manchester and Leeds. All that's good stuff. But I think there's also, you know, some immediate short-term issues that our members are quite vocal on about where they need some of that money released in now to make up for that gap and basically that underinvestment over the last few decades, to be quite honest.
Great, thanks. And Chris, agriculture, is this a major part of international trade negotiations, especially for emerging markets like India? The Northwest is home to the four of the most vulnerable farming areas, including Lake District and Yorkshire Dales. Mm-hmm. What is the mood regarding how local farmers will compete outside of the EU?
It's not something I've got a huge amount of intelligence on. We don't have, as a chairman, that level of membership within the sort of agricultural community. However, obviously, you know, there is a big supply chain element there, and food manufacture is one of the major sectors, both around Greater Manchester and in other parts of the north. And again, there are obvious concerns there over what this actually looks like, you know, post-May 2019, post-March 2019, when we're outside of the EU. And I think this is part of a much bigger piece of work that government really needs to get a grip on, to be quite honest, to give that level of certainty, to give a bit of clarity out to some absolutely fundamental, you know, major important sectors, not just for regional economies, but for national economies as well, such as agriculture, over what some of this may look like outside of the EU. And at the present moment in time, people are second-guessing. They're coming up with all sorts of different types of scenarios, often, you know, maybe accurate, maybe inaccurate. But that doesn't do anything when, for example, you are reliant on things, for example, like investment into the sector, both from home and abroad, to actually make it successful. So I think there's still an element of disquiet over what that actually looks like. Speaking to representatives from the agricultural community, it did seem to be sort of split, as I think most communities were, over whether or not, on going back to the original vote, whether it would be better or not to be in the EU. I think there's still an awful lot of work that needs doing, dare I say, on the ground, to actually put across to people that are going to be impacted, probably more so than other sectors directly, over what happens outside of the EU. There's a lot of stake here, and it's not just a case of, well, you know, it's a factory closing down or anything like that, which is bad in itself. This is a major part of the UK economy. And, you know, one that is, as we've seen, is vulnerable to changes in the past. So things need sorting out pretty quickly on this, and some level of certainty really putting out there.
Thanks. And Chris Southworth, what do you think?
I think agriculture is a really interesting one. I mean, if you look at, it's an interesting disconnect, isn't there, between the business sort of community, the business representative bodies like us, and the farming community. If you go back in time, the NFU, the National Farmers Union, was a key member of ICC, all the way up to joining the EU. You know, they're with us out on the international agenda, the international sort of platform, advocating for the UK. With the emergence of the EU, of course, that focus has been much more regional level. I think as the UK leaves the EU, there is a really good question about what the role of the UK agricultural community is within the wider business community. And Chris is completely right, actually. It's, we probably need to be talking more today in the context of supply chains and the role of the agricultural sector within that much bigger supply chain. And of course, food and drink companies in the UK play a huge role at global level. So I think that's an important point to say. The other important point around agriculture, of course, is when you get into an international setting, you know, at UK level, agriculture is actually a very small part of the overall economy because we're largely financial services, professional services and services more general. When you get into the international arena, agriculture is number one. And it's number one predominantly because the big emerging economies are also agricultural led. It's still a huge part of the Indian economy. It's an enormous part of the Chinese economy. And when you get into Latin America and places like that, it's a big part of what those economies are about. And that means that it becomes a much more important part of the negotiations and discussions. If the UK is trying to agree a trade agreement with a particular region, then agriculture is often the number one barrier. It's how much is there a give and a take on the price of lamb or the price of fish or whatever that might be. And in the EU setting, the UK agricultural community has been, you know, pretty protected. It's one of the most subsidised and protected agricultural regions in the world alongside the US. As the UK leaves, you know, you're effectively into the open market. Now, the New Zealanders and the Australians and the Argentinians and the Brazilians, these guys are serious, kind of highly competitive agricultural markets. And there's going to be an adjustment period there for the UK. And there's some very interesting questions around regional economies like the Northwest, where you do have these vulnerable areas. How are those economies who clearly can't compete in the same way that East Anglia can, how's that going to play out in the longer run? That's going to be an interesting question.
Thank you.
Can I just add something?
Yeah.
I think the other thing on that point as well is when you look at sort of customs agreements and things like that, if you start to, you know, if you're more reliant on some of that basic food stuff then having to be imported or whatever it may well be, there could obviously be absolutely, you know, major impacts on the price of food, you know, and it's at that point that people suddenly start to notice things and so it suddenly becomes real for a huge number of people. Because I do think something like this tends to get ignored because it's all around you. You take some of this stuff for absolute, you know, you take it for granted, don't you, that your bread, your meats, your fish, and another is there, without really, I think, most people giving it a second thought as to where it actually comes from. And I think that is potentially something that does need addressing sooner rather than later to make sure that there is not this absolutely huge, drastic impact on prices following the leaving of the EU.
Thank you very much. And finally, and Chris Fletcher, this is aimed at you. How does the Manchester business community feel about the UK and now it's leaving the EU?
It's a very interesting one. Before the referendum in the sort of surveys we were doing with our members, it was roughly 2/3 against 1/3 in favour of staying within the EU. Since the result came out, I think some businesses have sort of taken the viewpoint that let's just get on with this now and let's get the best deal we possibly can do. Other people are still wishing there could be a way of actually overturning the results of the referendum and getting back to the status quo and one thing and another. However, I think there is that element of realism and practical approach to this that, you know, it is going to happen. And I think a lot of businesses are wanting to see it, you know, see it delivered in the best way possible. The last survey we did, it was quite stark because there was a huge majority against this idea of, you know, no deal is the one potential option. A lot of our members are saying there has to be a deal of type in place. They will feel very, very comfortable with that, with a, you know, some form of transition period. 3 years, I think, was the sort of favoured result from that. And this whole idea of this sort of, you know, hard Brexit and, you know, just pull up stumps, as it were, and walk away when the negotiations finished and come what may after that. That was resoundingly rejected. You know, about 90-odd percent, 95% of respondents did not want what could be classed as a hard Brexit. They wanted some form of a customs union agreement or some other form of single market agreement in place at the end of the negotiation. So while I think there is this pragmatic approach of we are where we are, let's get on with it, that is not a let's get on with it at any cost. There has got to be something in place, I think, just to make sure that business will carry on the day after we leave in the same way pretty much as it does now. But obviously it will be different, but it's got to work in favour of business in the UK.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for joining us, Chris Fletcher, and thank you for joining us, Chris Southworth. We are now broadcasting to 17 countries, from Sri Lanka to the USA. If you'd like to come and speak on a topical world business issue, please let us know by emailing events@iccwbo.uk. You've been listening to the World Business Podcast from the ICC United Kingdom. Thank you.